one clear example of the success and the value of being able to do this return stacking, even at a pension plan level, is the Delta Pension Plan.
Right.
We interviewed John Glidden, who recently won a couple of awards for what he's accomplished. But when he took over the pension plan, I think it was in 2011, the Delta Pension Plan was underfunded. It was underfunded by over 65%. And they needed to come up quick with a solution as to how to get it to funded level. Part of it was going to be the Delta management was going to have to put some money into the pension plan. But the other half was John coming in and saying, listen, I got an idea. Why don't we do 60-40 plus a bunch of alternative mandates on top? And I think this is the fastest way to actually do better than the benchmarks and get us to funded. And since then, they've gone from underfunded to just slightly overfunded using that approach. So it is something that, yes, it definitely benefited in the last decade. I think we're going to see continued benefits now for retail investors over the coming decade.
This is Raise Your Average. For decades, investors have faced a fundamental challenge: how to effectively diversify their portfolios without sacrificing returns. The conventional wisdom has been that adding alternative investments requires selling a portion of core holdings, often leading to underperformance when traditional assets rally. But what if there was a way to achieve diversification without making that trade-off? Enter Return Stacking and the newly launched Return Stack Global Balanced and Macro ETF, ticker RGBM, listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, which seeks to provide a more capital-efficient approach to portfolio construction. This launch builds on the success of the return-stacked suite of U.S. ETFs, which have now attracted over $1.4 billion Canadian dollars in AUM in under 2 years. Return-stacked ETFs is the brainchild of the partnership between Resolve Asset Management and Newfound Research. Joining me are Rodrigo Gordillo, president at Resolve Asset Management, and Corey Hofstein, CEO at Newfound Research.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AdvisorAnalyst.com or of our guests. This broadcast is meant to be for informational purposes only. Nothing discussed in this broadcast is intended to be considered as advice.
Rodrigo, Corey, it is great to see you guys and get this chance to talk to you about return stacking.
Thanks for having us again, Pierre.
Yeah, great to be here. Thank you.
Gentlemen, first of all, what was the genesis of return stacking?
You mentioned that return stacking is this joint venture between my firm, Newfound Research, and Resolve Asset Management. And I think where we came together on this was we were both facing the same fundamental problem, which you outlined beautifully in that introduction, which is that both of our firms were really large proponents of alternative diversification during the 2010s, which was a decade in which nobody wanted to diversify. And in fact, diversification objectively hurt you. I come from a U.S. perspective. You could not have done better than just a U.S. 60-40 from a risk-adjusted return perspective. And so that was a very difficult decade to try to convince investors that indeed diversification was worth having in the portfolio. Because at the end of the day, you were always apologizing for diversification. It was consistently underperforming stocks and bonds. And so I don't know, what's that statement? Madness is, or lunacy is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. I think at the end of the decade, both Resolve and Newfound were looking at ourselves saying, everyone agrees they want more diversification, but what we're finding is that pragmatically and behaviorally, diversification can be really hard to stick with. And the risk is that people were entering more and more concentrated portfolios at a time where we were looking around and saying, the risk is that the world could become more fragile. We want to help people get that diversification in there, but we need to do it in a sustainable way. And so we came together and sort of discussed this idea of capital efficiency, something that we had been using in some of our own portfolios, but wasn't maybe the core feature. And it was something that institutions had been doing for decades, and we can get into that and say, well, why don't we make this the core feature? This is a really powerful tool when focused on that advisors can use to improve the diversification of their portfolios without having to upend their core stock and bond position. And so we sort of rethought what a product suite could look like when you focus on this idea of capital efficiency and return stacking at its core. And by the way, I need to give due credit to Rodrigo for coming up with the name return stacking. I think it's been a really powerful, not just brand for us, but a way to explain what we're trying to achieve, which is ultimately stacking the returns of diversifying asset classes and strategies on top of those core stock and bond positions.
And for those who don't know where that kind of concept of return stacking, what the rebrand was from, it came from Portable Alpha, which in an interesting twist, when we started talking about this, nobody wanted to even say the word Portable Alpha because of a few things that happened in 08 and poorly constructed return stacking approaches from an institutional perspective. Today, it's come back into vogue. And it's come back in vogue because people are recognizing, okay, this may be the time that we actually need to stack diversifiers on top. And too many advisors, I think, have gotten burnt by making room in their portfolios for diversifiers. The way institutions, thoughtful institutions, have always done it is this concept of 60-40 plus, where you overlay the alternatives on top. And now we have new regulations in Canada and the U.S. that allow us to clearly define the use of alternatives and derivatives as a stack so that we can deliver institutional quality portable alpha, i.e. return stacking, in an ETF or a mutual fund wrapper. So that's been the big move and innovation.
Yeah, it's interesting. If I step back for a moment and think about this concept, you could have brought this concept to market under normal circumstances, obviously, not under the circumstances you just described, Rod. But you could have brought this to market, you know, in the past, to where you mentioned, Corey, 10 years ago, let's say, and introduced it, and investors could have used it, stacked the alpha or absolute return, managed futures, whatever's, you know, on top of their portfolios, and still not sacrifice the returns that 60-40 provided. So it kind of has a universality. It's not something that's just pertinent today, although it is. It's something that could have been pertinent 10, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, if it was available.
Just the reality is, as much as this is now becoming in vogue and return stacking has taken off, it's been around for over 40 years, right? It started with PIMCO. And if anybody has been following some of the PIMCO kind of institutional mandates, one of their core mandates was, one of the first portable alpha mandates was this idea of having an S&P 500 futures contract, and then stacked on top, they would have their alpha by bond picking. So basically it was 100% equities, 100% bonds.
Right.
And if you look back at the performance of that fund, it is exactly what they wanted it to be. You just kind of add a bond performance on top, and then you stack on top the excess returns of the S&P 500, and that's what the fund gave you. And that fund was used to create space in portfolios to add diversifiers, right? So it's not anything new. It's things that institutions have used for a long time. And in fact, if you want to talk about the last 10, 15 years, one clear example of the success and the value of being able to do this return stacking, even at a pension plan level, is the Delta Pension Plan.
Right.
We interviewed John Glidden, who recently won a couple of awards for what he's accomplished. But when he took over the pension plan, I think it was in 2011, the Delta pension plan was underfunded. It was underfunded by over 65%. And they needed to come up quick with a solution as to how to get it to funded level. Part of it was going to be the Delta management was going to have to put some money into the pension plan. But the other half was John coming in and saying, listen, I got an idea. Why don't we do 60-40 plus a bunch of alternative mandates on top? And I think this is the fastest way to actually do better than the benchmarks and get us to funded. And since then, they've gone from underfunded to just slightly overfunded using that approach. So it is something that, yes, it definitely benefited in the last decade. I think we're going to see continued benefits now for retail investors over the coming decade.
And you have to give real credit to Jonathan, by the way, because he was doing this in an era where Portable Alpha went completely out of vogue. Right after 2008, you had a huge amount of structural issues with the implementation of Portable Alpha, but also just the general appetite for leverage derivatives and shorting was gone. I mean, I remember very clearly post-2008, there were fund brochures that said right on the front page, no leverage, no shorting, no derivatives, as if that was a key feature of the product, right? And Portable Alpha requires the use of the thoughtful use of derivatives, right? The thoughtful use of leverage, using leverage for diversification, not concentration. And so, right, Jonathan went very against the grain and was rewarded for it. Now, these, as Rod mentioned, these types of strategies can be opened up to all investors because regulators have sort of created a framework with which they can be put into fund vehicles.
Yeah. So capital efficiency. So historically, investors seeking diversification have turned to alternative strategies when they were seeking diversification, such as managed futures, commodities, systematic macro strategies. However, the dilemma, of course, that's the need to fund those allocations by reducing stock and bond holdings. For advisors, this is, you know, ultimately ends up being line item risk or tracking error risk. Talk about how return stacking can solve for that dilemma that advisors and investors face.
You know, for that question, we just have to go back to the original promise of diversifying liquid alternatives, such as managed futures, systematic macro. And the promise is that it's going to have very low conditional correlation to equities and bonds, right? And upon first blush, you feel like, okay, that's exactly what I want. I want something that's very different from my equities and bonds. But the reality is that advisors and investors have spent decades understanding and getting to know or feel correctly about the movements of equities and bonds. They can understand why they're going up and down. When there's a recession, equities are down, everybody else is down. Okay, there's nothing we could do. We can stick to it, maybe a bit better. Not all. We're still dealing with, you know, myopic loss aversion and all that. But people have learned to stick to these asset classes. When you add a third asset class that may be going down 10% when the S&P is up 40, delivering on that promise of non-correlation, you know, zigging when the other asset class is zagging, when you deliver on that, but it's a negative delivery, there's no diamond hands, right? Nobody's holding tight to that. And when I remember being back, like when I started in the business back in 2004, where managed futures managers would come and say, look, if you grab our equity line and then you stack, you just kind of combine it with equity, with traditional equities or 60-40, you get this other beautifully smooth equity line that that your clients are going to benefit from. Now, the problem was that in paper, that looks great, that third equity line, that combined equity line.
Yeah.
But in practice, they're not seeing that combined equity line. They're seeing two separate lines.
Yeah.
And so part of the magic of putting two for one in the return stacked ETFs, where you're getting a dollar of traditional betas in traditional markets and a dollar of something different, is that you're actually getting that promise of the third line, where the client gets to see that smoother line in their portfolios. And markets are up 30, managed futures are down 10, that line is up 20.
Right.
You know, it's a lot tougher for an advisor to be like, an investor to be like, hey, you only made me 20% this year, right? So part of the value here, much like private equity, there's a lot of value in smoothing out the NAV. We're doing a similar thing, but with fully mark-to-market liquid every single day. We're smoothing out the line. We're making it easier for advisors to put diversifiers in their portfolios and for clients to hold those diversifiers and create a bit more of the diamond hand phenomenon. And I think that's, aside from the added diversification, I think the combination of these two things is what makes return stacking even more unique.
Yeah, I want to paraphrase Cliff Asness really quickly, because he talks about this idea about statistical time versus behavioral time, right? And we've all seen these beautiful 30, 40 year back tests. And that's when you're evaluating something in statistical time, right? You see this little, oh, the alternative underperformed core stocks and bonds over this 1 year period. Not a big deal. And because you see the rest of the back tests. And so you're fast forwarding through that whole year of questioning and pain and underperformance by just looking at this 40 year period. That's statistical time. Behavioral time is going through that in real time and going through a year or two or three of relative underperformance. And it's not just a year or two or three. It's like dog years, right? Yeah. It's 7, 14, 21. And by the end of 3 years, you're going, this thing is never going to work again. Even though you can go back and take a look at the statistical time, you convince yourself, nope, this time is different. Diversification's broken. This is no longer going to work for me. And so in reality, we think not only is return stacking a superior way to embed diversification and construct portfolios, just objectively, we think on paper, theoretically, it's a better way to do it. But we think it substantially improves the behavioral experience for a lot of investors. And that's really critical, right? Because the optimal portfolio is first and foremost the one an investor can actually stick with. And so when you can keep those core stocks and bonds and add the diversifiers on top, it makes that relative underperformance far less painful at the portfolio level, but also at the line item level. When you can combine those alts with stocks and bonds into the same ticker, it should not be overlooked how much of a potential benefit there is there. I hate to say it, but it's sort of a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. But it really, it's just the core concept of diversification. You're adding stocks, bonds, and an alternative all into one ticker. There should be less variance in that equity curve.
Very interesting. I was thinking of an analogy. You know, imagine you've got your home and you want to add a solarium to your kitchen back end. And you think, okay, well, you know, why don't we turn part of the kitchen into a solarium? And then you end up having a kitchen that is split between being a solarium and being the kitchen. Or you could just build an extension off the kitchen into the back, right? Which is completely separate. And have the you know, I was just thinking, you know, I could just see, you know, a couple standing there and saying, well, I don't know if I'm in the kitchen or the solarium anymore. You know, this is crazy. I don't like it at all. Right. This is the line.
Right. And actually to add to your
analogy. Away from the kitchen.
To add to your analogy there, it's the equivalent of, okay, I own this much land and the municipality won't let me expand my land.
Right.
Right. This is all the land I have. So I kind of have to fit this. If I want a solarium, I have to fit it in the kitchen. What's happened in the last few years is that the regulators, i.e. the municipality, has said, okay, you can actually build a solarium maybe on the third floor, or we'll let you expand your land. And you can build, you can have that as an add-on to your portfolio, to your land. So I think that's the key thing here, right? Is that we were limited historically to a plot of land where you had to make room for everything. Now we're able to extend the canvas or the land by which we can invest.
But you can see where neither the kitchen or the solarium under the first circumstance would be satisfying to anyone. Exactly. That's the problem with...
Well, in the first circumstance, you're not even getting a blend. In the first circumstance, you've got your house, right? And you're not allowed to build up and you're stuck on your land. So you say, I'm getting rid of a bedroom to add a solarium, right?
Yeah.
And now I'm sleeping on the solarium floor. In the second case, it's let's add a solarium on top of the house,
right?
And we get to keep all the utilized space that we have in the house originally and add this nice new feature that we want.
For the risk of expanding this solarium out even further, the other key thing that we're not doing is we're not adding a second kitchen. We're not adding more of the same thing, right? Because this is the problem, I think, when people think about return stacking portable alpha. It's like leverage is bad. You know, leverage is bad, or adding a second kitchen is probably not a great idea. There's not a lot of value there, right? If you decide that you're going to be a great cook and then all of a sudden, you know, you create a second kitchen and all of a sudden you just don't want to cook anymore, then you've wasted a bunch of space and your kind of proverbial house stock has gone down, right? So I think it's important to understand that, yes, we're talking about leverage. But there's a big difference, and oftentimes we are compared to the double bull, double bear ETFs, where you're levering too much of the same risk. And I think as the portable alpha space evolves, there's going to be much more talk about derivatives and leverage and overlay solutions. And I think advisors and investors need to really be able to differentiate between, you know, excessive leverage and defensive leverage. I think there's an acronym that one of our sales members came up with that I absolutely love. And it's the idea that, you know, none of us want lice, right? Everybody hates lice. We want to avoid lice as much as possible. But lice in our circumstance means leverage that is illiquid, concentrated, and excessive, right? You want to avoid lice. You want to avoid things that are illiquid, concentrated, and excessive. And those double bull ETFs are, they're liquid, but they're concentrated and they're excessive. So these are the things that you need to look out for and say, okay, what is it that we do want? Well, what we do want is defensive leverage that's non-correlated to our core holdings, that is liquid, and that it is diversified as possible, right? Well, the reason that we gravitated initially towards things like managed futures and systematic macro is because the correlation to equities and bonds are so low. And in fact, they have a unique quirk that they tend to do really well directionally, taking the opposite bets when things are going poorly for equities and bonds. And you can see that by looking at any systematic macro index or managed futures index in periods like 2000, 2003, 2008, 2022, that historically we've observed, you know, double-digit positive returns.
Okay, so
when you needed the most.
Let's get into that. Using the global balanced and macro strategy that you get in the RGBM wrapper, that allows investors to add systematic macro on top of their portfolios in a capital efficient way without having to reduce their exposure to their core stock and bond allocation. So let's get into that. Why would you want to do that?
Well, I think the first thing is let's start with continuing talking about the idea of non-concentration.
Right.
Systematic macro invests in four major categories: global equity indices, global bond, sovereign bond indices, all types of commodities, and all types of currencies, right? We're looking at over 50 different futures contracts for this ETF. And so when we talk about diversity, the first thing that people need to understand is that it'll probably be the most diverse allocation that they're going to have in their portfolios. And that's step one. That's why it's number one. It's so important as a stack. Now, the question is, in what proportion do we hold those 50 plus securities? And when do we go long and short? And so then the next, what systematic macro tends to be, is just a fancy word for multi-strat in a systematic way, right? You're looking at ways to choose whether to go long or short gold. And, you know, the OG of managed futures, or these are futures contracts that we're investing in, started with the simple, hey, listen, if the trend is your friend, if things are going up, if they're above the 200-day moving average, I want to go long these things. Anything below, I want to go short. And then it went from 200-day moving average to diversified moving averages to breakout systems. And that became trend following, right? And that is a very powerful system. It is very simple to understand. And we have launched a few ETFs with just that sleeve. On the systematic macro side, you go further, you take the next step and you say, okay, well, is there any mean reversion in these? Can I create a mean reversion strategy that does positive returns but is non-correlated to trend? And then can we look at seasonal patterns? You know, the very famous Canadian ETF, HAC, is a great example of how seasonality plus trend can do really, really well. I mean, they've absolutely crushed it over the last 10 plus years. And it's, by the way, seasonality, Corey and I can both attest to the fact that when we first heard this phenomenon, we're like, no way, it's just not a real thing. It turns out it's a very real thing, right? You can imagine that there's seasonal patterns for commodities. There's even seasonal patterns for, you know, equities. Sell and main go away is a simplistic way to look at it. But you keep going down the line, right? So seasonality, mean reversion, relative value, carry strategies. Systematic macro is just a multi-strat decision maker where each one of these sleeves is voting every single day as to whether they should be long or short gold or any other commodity, and how by how much. You aggregate those and you make a decision. And we can be, the system can aggregate the signals so that, you know, it can be net long a bunch of stuff, net short a bunch of stuff, or net neutral. It is not a market neutral strategy just trying to create returns no matter what. The feature is that it can be concentrated long or short, so that in periods like 08, that concentration can lead to a lot of offset that will offset equities and bonds. So that's why we thought that our first foray into Canada would be kind of the full-fledged, you know, what is our best foot forward in protecting against equities and bonds. And then the base for the RGB METF is a 50% global equity.
Right.
And a 50% Canadian bond portfolio. So you're getting 50-50 plus the systematic macro overlay.
So a dollar.
I'm going to just add it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say just right where you're going, Pierre. So if someone has $100 in their portfolio and they're 60% global bonds and 60% global stocks and 40% Canadian bonds, they could sell, you know, $10 of their global stocks. They could sell $10 of their Canadian bonds, put $20 into the ETF, and they're going to get their $10 of stocks and bonds back. So the underlying 60-40 remains whole, but now they have $20 of this overlay, systematic macro overlay, put on top of their portfolio. And so it's the idea of putting that base there is not only do we now have three legs of the stool within the ETF, but it makes it hopefully very easy for advisors to implement this in their portfolio and understand, you know, sell a dollar of stocks, sell a dollar of bonds, put $2 into this fund and you get those stocks and bonds back.
Yeah. So post the allocation, you wind up with your $100 of 60-40 plus $20 of systematic macro.
Correct.
So 1.2 to 1 for 20% shift, you wind up with an additional 20% of systematic macro on top of your 100 of core.
That's right.
So what are some other ways of thinking about using RGBM?
Okay, well, I think we talked about the use case of, you know, stacking things on top, right? Corey went through an idea where you're going to have, by allocating 20% of this portfolio to your 60-40, you're going to have, when you x-ray into it, you're going to see 60% equities, 40% bonds, and then a 20% allocation of systematic macro. The client will be seeing something like 50, 30, 20, right? They'll be seeing three line items, assuming that, you know, you just have one line item per asset class. Now, some advisors are already kind of want to reduce equities and bonds. They may feel like, hey, listen, this is not a good time to be getting a 60-40. Maybe I do want 10% less and 10% less of equities and bonds. And so the question is for people, and a lot of these advisors are already allocating to managed futures as a single line item, right? And so what's interesting is these conversations, they do not want to stack things on top. They want to have 20% in managed futures or systematic macro, and they want to have, you know, 50, 30, let's say.
Right.
How can they use, and I'll say the last thing is, but they're feeling the pain from investors over the last couple of years, notwithstanding 2022, which is a bang up year for managed futures. They're getting a lot of questions from investors as to why are we holding this 20% allocation, right?
Right.
And so the line item risk is still there. So how can return stacked help you minimize the behavioral pain of doing the right thing? Well, in this case, all you would do is you would sell your systematic macro single line item that is hurting you from a behavioral perspective. And then you would sell down 10% of your equities, 10% of your bonds, buy back the RGBM, in which case you will have your, you know, 30% bonds, 50% equity, and then you'll be left with 20% cash. Right. So the client will now see 20% cash, 20% RGBM, and then 20% bonds and 30% equities. When you add all those things up, when you x-ray them, you're actually getting 20% in liquid alternative, and you're getting your 50-30, right? That's the x-ray. But the client sees cash, RGBM, and a little bit of equities and bonds. And so in a way, that cash component can be used further. So the line item in RGBM is a lot smoother, easier to hold. The cash component makes the investor feel a bit safer. It's like, okay, you're being cautious here. And they could just invest it in a high yield savings account and get a slightly extra yield. They can invest it in maybe a slightly higher duration if they want. Or maybe if they really want to just stack a very, very low volatility alternative, they could find a market neutral manager that they liked to stack on top, right? So it gives that cash, allows for flexibility. Let's say the markets crash. Well, they could use that as dry powder to buy at the right time. So that is another use case that we found more and more people using, especially those that already allocate to alternatives and are feeling the behavioral pain of holding that different line item.
Yeah, so the first case, right, that we went over is you want to include alternatives, but you don't want to make room, so you can use RGBM as an overlay. The second use case that Rod just outlined is you already have alternatives, but they're causing a line item problem. And so you can use RGBM to push those alternatives into a single ticker with stocks and bonds, hopefully creating a smoother equity curve, maintaining the same allocation you already have, but now having that line item be a little bit more palatable and have a nice chunk of cash that sits there, again, that can be behaviorally useful. And potentially, as Rod points out, you know, you can use it in a variety of other ways. The third way I'd point out is we often talk about using these alternatives as an additional diversifier, which we think is really critically important. But you could also think of this as a potential return enhancer, right? A lot of people are looking to beat the market, and a lot of people do that via security selection. But if you look at all the Morningstar reports, all the SPIVA reports, all of them are going to show you that beating the market is really, really hard. We have all the investors in the world fishing in the same pond, and equity markets are historically incredibly efficient, right? I know the stats in the US much better than I know Canada, but you know, over the last 15 years, only 10% of large cap managers in the US beat their benchmark, right? And so one of the things we like to say is, well, why are we playing the game on hard mode? Why do we keep spending our active risk budget in a place where, somewhat tautologically, it's almost impossible to beat the market because we're competing with so many other people? Why not, instead of having an active stock picker, why don't we say, well, can we just try to find something that we can stack on top that we think is more likely to have a positive return than not? Doesn't need to beat the market, just needs to beat cash, right? And so if we think a systematic macro strategy can return 2-3% per year annualized, and we're trying to beat the market, well, why not? Why don't we think about potentially getting rid of some of our active stock pickers that historically have not worked particularly well, just hold the core beta that we want, and add an overlay as a potential return enhancer, right? And so those are the three major ways we typically see advisors utilize us. One, to introduce us as a diversifier. Two, to help with the line item risk that they deal with and smash their existing alternatives into a single line item with stocks and bonds. And then three, they actually think of us as a return enhancer, particularly for their growth clients. The ability to add a truly differentiated additional source of returns onto their core stocks and bonds.
Right. Like any sort of any cash beater that you mentioned, cash beaters, long, short, merger, arbitrage, right? For
exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, or just our right systematic macro strategy. There's a variety of ways in which these building blocks all come together. But in the case of RGBM in particular, right, there are really three ways in which an advisor can use it. And that last way is just to say, I think systematic macro is going to have a positive return. I think it's more likely to have a positive return than my active stock pickers are of finding alpha. Why don't I spend my active risk budget with an overlay rather than through security selection?
There's still a lot of advisors out there that are part of their value proposition is I'm going to do better than 60/40. And the way they've done it up until now is they are finding managers that can find better bonds over time, pick better bonds over time, and pick better stocks over time. And what we know from the SPIVA reports is that is a very difficult game to win. And in fact, when I looked at the data, we're looking at if you had pre-picked the top quartile, right? If you had pre-picked, if you know who they were, you're looking at an excess return of maybe 1%, maybe above, slightly above 1%. When you look at the other option, which is I'll just buy a 40% traditional bond index and a 60% traditional equity index, and then I stack, let's say, managed futures or systematic macro, those tend to do, or historically have shown in terms of excess returns, to be, you know, 200-400 basis points excess returns on top that you can stack.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, when you look at how often the stock pickers, you know, at the end of the year where you stock picking correctly, you can see your client, this year I outperformed the market. My research shows that it's about 50% of the time you're saying your clients, I beat it. 50% of the times I didn't beat it. And when you look back at the options for stacking liquid alternatives on top, we're looking at 7 to 8 out of 10 years you're stacking positives. You're having that outperformance conversation more often in more calendar years with clients, right? So that's from return stacking to outperform. If that is your business, if that is part of your value proposition, at the very least, you should explore it as an option.
The options that it opens up for investors, advisors and investors, in terms of what you can do to incrementally add to that return, the excess returns you're talking about, that's probably, I mean, I think that's one of the most astonishing things about return stacking is that, you know, if you think about not having to sacrifice your core, you know, your beta, your core returns, and then being able to stack on an additional 1 or 2% of net incremental return on top of that, that's a much easier way to get that incremental return or that excess return than to try and beat the S&P 500.
John Glidden put it, this is the Delta CIO. He said, you know, it feels like we're cheating, but we're winning. Yeah. I think that's how it feels. Right?
I think what's interesting about that too, the way you phrased that, Pierre, is like 1 or 2% excess return on its own is probably not an interesting standalone.
Yeah.
Position, right? Most people wouldn't sell stocks and bonds to add something that's going to do 1% above cash or even 2% above cash. Like they're just going to hold their core stocks and bonds. But if you can add that 1 or 2% on top, right, suddenly it becomes very interesting. I was having a conversation with an institution and they were talking about, and we were talking specifically about stacking managed futures, trend following, and they were saying, well, is it a good time for trend following? Do we want to market time this? And I said, Let's ignore the fact we're talking about trend following for a second. Let me take a big step back. If I had an active equity strategy, because we're talking about stacking trend on equities alone. If I had an active equity strategy that has historically, for the last 25 years, generated 300 basis points of annualized excess return, done so in a way that's been totally uncorrelated to stocks and bonds, and has historically actually had negative correlation of stocks when stocks have gone down, as well as negative correlation to bonds during inflationary shocks. Does that sound like an interesting thing you'd want in your portfolio? You know, does that sound more attractive than buying value stocks or momentum stocks, right? Yes, let's ignore the fact we're doing trend following for a second. I'm just giving you stocks and bonds plus some active strategy, right? And typically that active strategy is, you know, again, security selection, trying to pick stocks and bonds better. But why are we constraining ourselves to that, right? As Rod mentioned earlier, systematic macro in particular is all these really interesting strategies embedded within it, trend following and mean reversion and seasonality. And there's you know, a half dozen others. And it's diversifying you out of just stocks and bonds. It's giving you access to a whole slew of global commodities and currency markets to trade, right? Just expanding the breadth with which you have access to find excess returns. To me, it sounds like the odds are tilted much more in my favor with that approach than, again, going back to where all the statistics tell us it is almost impossible to beat the market.
Well, I think, you know, if you stop and think for a moment, you know, beating the market with the market, that's difficult. That's, you know, finding that alpha within the original source is why the odds are against you. The reason people have done so well in beta in S&P 500 is because 7 or 8 stocks provided 55% of the return most recently. It's not because the entire index did extremely well. It's because a very small number of stocks drove most of the return. So could you find the additional 2 or 3 or 4 stocks? Possibly, but the odds are against you.
Right.
In doing
that, the
right, you might actually harm your efforts rather than benefit them by trying to do that.
To have outperformed, to be a manager to have outperformed the S&P, you would have had to either find stocks that outperformed the Mag 7 or
right,
overweighted the Mag 7. Right? Like, point to me a manager that would do either of those things. Right? It is incredibly difficult in the most liquid and competitive market to really eke out alpha. And remember, the stats I gave you were about the top quartile in the past 10, 15 years. That doesn't mean that top quartile is going to be the best performer over the next 15 years, right? It's really difficult to pick the managers that did well in a particular regime. So yeah, this just adds credence to the fact that maybe stock selection for outperformance isn't the way to go. Maybe stacking completely different, you know, well-trodden, well-recognized alternative strategies on top that are more consistent in terms of outperformance. So when you look at the indices, that's maybe a better way to go.
Okay. All right. So now we've talked about return stacking. We've talked about capital efficiency. We've talked about how to exchange parts of your portfolio dollar for dollar for your core stock and bond, and add dollar for dollar to systematic macro. We've talked about three reasons you might want to do this, three ways of approaching this strategically. What is the benefit of systematic macro? What are the key benefits of systematic macro? Like, why now? We've talked about, you know, okay, you can add systematic macro, but there's also reasons why systematic macro is uncorrelated. There's features and benefits to systematic macro. Systematic macro as a strategy has a track record of performing in certain times, how it performs in good times and bad times, or on sunny days and rainy days. What are those? What are the reasons for saying, okay, I want systematic macro? Well, I think you have to have that desire, right? You have to want systematic macro in order to see.
Yeah, you have to. And look, I'll tell you what my journey was when I started in the business. So my dad was a math professor. I came from statistics and finance. I had no choice but to invest using data. And if you start at first principles and you say, okay, look, as many people maybe have heard my story, like, I saw my family's wealth get deteriorated by hyperinflation, then big bear markets. Like, it was just concentrated bets hurting us over and over again. And so when I looked at the data and went back to 1926, which is as far as I could get back when I was in my early 20s, first of all, you wanted to identify asset classes that move differently from each other, right? Equities and bonds broadly move differently from each other, but sometimes move in the same direction if there's inflation. Okay, so what does well in inflation? Well, it turns out the commodities do well during periods of inflation. What other asset classes are there that will respond differently depending on different central bank policies? Well, currencies do different things. So when you start looking into that, and then you say, okay, who in the hedge fund universe, if I wanted to look at the least correlated asset classes, with whether it's long short equity, market neutral, merger arb, managed futures, systematic macro, the two categories that stood out to me back then and continue to show up over and over again are managed futures trend and systematic macro, which includes managed futures trend and other stuff.
Right.
So that's why, and it's because when you think about the fundamental reasons as to why it's different and different, aggressively different when you need it the most, is because, let's take 2022, for example, right? What worked in 2022? Well, equities didn't work and bonds didn't work, right? They both went down roughly the same amount if you're looking at long-term treasuries. Many advisors were shocked by the fact that they both went down together. We weren't. We knew that would move other markets. What moved? What moved was commodities, right? They had a killer first quarter in 2022. What is systematic macro? Every one of the iterations, whether it's seasonality to mean reversion, what are we all trying to do? We're trying to identify what is working best. And when there is most dispersion, when there is the most continuation of movement in all these asset classes, is when you get the better, the most results out of systematic macro. And Q1 2022 was one of them. Q3 2008 was another big movement of all asset classes, and systematic macro is trying to identify the best bets and then push on those bets. And so why now? Why systematic macro? Because you get to have things that can thrive during inflationary periods. You can short things that are hurting in deflationary periods. Right. And then when there is a normal market, when there's not a lot of extended wild movements that are prolonged, when it's just like chugging along, equities and bonds and currencies are kind of sideways, well, that's likely going to be less opportunity, but not zero opportunity. We may not be making 30%, but we may be making 3 or 4. Again, as a standalone, that sucks when the S&P is up 15 a year, but as a stack on top, it's pretty good, right? So right. Systematic macro, if we're wrong and there isn't a paradigm shift and things are going to go back to normal, you're still expecting a decent single-digit rate of return on top of your stack. But when things do go wrong and there's prolonged trends, the likelihood that systematic macro is going to provide a large offset is going to be high. And that's why I like this asset class as a first launch in Canada, out of everything that I've seen.
So let me try to do a quick summary there because Rod went through a lot, right? So systematic macro is going to give you access to additional asset classes, right? Not just your core stocks and bonds, but it's going to give you access to currencies and global commodities. So that's an opportunity for diversification. It's flexible. You can be both long and short. So you're not just necessarily long stocks, long bonds, long commodities, but it has the flexibility to go both long and short, which means it can profit in all sorts of market environments. Systematic macro is going to combine a number of unique edges, right? So we've mentioned things like trend and mean reversion and seasonality and carry and skewness and all these other interesting edges that on their own are not only uncorrelated to stocks and bonds historically, but are uncorrelated to each other, right? So you're trying to create a better edge through the combination of different edges, right? And then finally, when you look at the historical empirical returns of this category, right? And you don't have to look at ours, right? You can go look at the hedge fund, you know, quantitative macro category. What you find is it has historically positive excess returns, right? Very appealing for stacking, historically uncorrelated to stocks and bonds, and has historically done well during equity market routes and inflationary periods, right? So when you talk about adding a third leg of the stool, it's the diversification of asset classes, diversification of strategies, and embedded flexibility that we think makes it such a strong third leg as an addition to existing stock and bond exposure.
And we do highlight that index in our brochures. If you go to returnstackedetfs.ca, there's a product brief there, presentation that kind of shows the history of that systematic macro index.
Good. I think one of the things that always sticks out for me is the structurally uncorrelated nature of this strategy. Is that, and by structurally uncorrelated, I mean, you know, when markets are under pressure, correlations tend to converge on one. Most assets will sell off in a high pressure situation in the market. You'll have correlations rise to one. But if you have structurally uncorrelated assets like systematic macro, you're not going to have that outcome where the structurally uncorrelated asset is actually also converging on one, like your stocks and bonds.
Right. I want to make sure that we kind of, you know, double click on what you just said. What people confuse during periods of duress is this concept that diversification within equities all go to one. Right. It doesn't matter what beautiful equities you own. If it's 08, they're all going down. They're 90% correlated to the downside, right?
Right.
And correlations get much, much tighter. Everybody's just selling indiscriminately all of their equities. And so that's what people mean by in periods of duress, all correlations go to one. But that has never been true if you give it enough days to when you compare the equity asset class to the bond asset class to the commodity asset class to gold to currencies. They're all very, very different at different times. In 08, correlations between equities and bonds went to negative in the most extreme negative correlations. Like the U.S. Treasury Index, TLT, just look it up, a few people know about this, was up 35% at a time when equities were down 35%.
Right.
So that was like that flies in the face of that idea that all correlations go to one. Commodities also went down in 08, right? But fast forward to 2022, when it was an inflationary bear market, then you did see correlations in equities and bonds go down together because, you know, rates are going up unexpectedly and there's a discount to cash flows for equities and bonds. But then the correlation of commodities went negative and went significantly higher. So there's always opportunities in non-correlated asset classes, even during periods of stress.
Yeah, but adding...
Even if correlations go to one, though...
That's right, yeah.
You have to consider that, again, these strategies have the flexibility to short.
Yeah.
Right? So there can be a bull market in a bear market, right? You don't... By not having to be structurally long, not only are we expanding the palette in which we can find opportunities across all these asset classes. Rod didn't even mention currencies, by the way. U.S. dollar did great in both 2008 and 2022, right? As there was sort of this flight to safety. But beyond that, even if the majority of asset classes are going down, even if you have stocks going down, bonds going down, commodities going down because there's a liquidity crunch, right? That's an opportunity that a systematic macro trader might be short all those asset classes and still find a way to profit, right? And so we're using a breadth of signals across a breadth of asset classes to try to maximize our opportunity for generating a positive return, regardless of what's happening in the macroeconomic or geopolitical environment.
But a structurally uncorrelated asset doesn't have a floating correlation to your stocks or your bonds. It kind of stands on its own with its own structural uncorrelation to those betas, right, or those stocks and bonds, right? And that makes it a key diversifier. I think that's basically the point I was trying to get to.
Yeah, when you
want to have an asset that's reliably uncorrelated in those times that will do what it does. And I appreciate, you know, Corey, thanks for the stressing on the fact that it's a dynamic process that can be long or short, that can favor, you know, that follows the trends literally. Like I always, you know, when I hear about trend following, I always think, you know, isn't that what investing was always supposed to be? You know, isn't that what investors, I mean, isn't that what end clients always expected their advisors to do? And yet, you know, there it is in a package that's always been available. And yet it's underutilized by retail investors.
Yeah, to that point about structurally uncorrelated, though, I do think it's worth pointing out, you know, when we use trend following as an example, the long-term average correlation of trend following to stocks and bonds is pretty much zero.
Right.
The point-in-time correlation can vary dramatically because it is a directional alternative, right? It can be very positively correlated with stocks when they're going up. It can be very negatively correlated with stocks when they're going down. And same for bonds, right? Systematic macro, when you start combining more and more strategies together, you're probably less likely to get those real extremely high correlations, but you're still going to see the correlation to the core betas ebb and flow. There is still the opportunity to generate return taking directional bets when you find that, oh, actually seasonality and trend and short-term mean reversion and carry and skewness and all these other strategies that are getting combined, they're all weighing in the same direction. Man, that might be a good time to press your bet for or against, right, depending on the direction of it, right, for that beta, right? And so systematic macro isn't just about being purely market neutral. There are these time varying betas that accompany it, and right, and so that's where and why you've historically seen something like systematic macro perform so well during equity market crises, because you are taking negatively correlated bets or you're outright shorting what's going down. So I do think that's an important point, that it is not purely always zero correlation, right? There are these time varying correlations that we see as being a core feature of systematic macro, not a bug.
So maybe the more important, maybe the more accurate statement would be that it acts as a reliable ballast.
Yeah. Yeah, in a long enough time frame, it certainly does. One thing to caution against, because I've seen a few of these funds that do basically a mirror image of what equities do, and it's there to really offset aggressively when the markets go down immediately the day that they start going down. You know, the difference there is that they're consistently different than the market, and they're consistently going to provide that. But there's not a lot of carry or, you know, positive expectation during bull markets. What Corey alluded to is that the ability for these systems to be in line with trends, in line with markets that are working, and participating when we want to participate, adds an extra level of excess returns at the right time.
Right.
In points of inflection, however, when, let's say, the systematic macro has been aligned with the current economic regime and there's an abrupt shift, there's always going to be a period of adjustment. This will take a few days to transition out of the old guard and into the new. So that's an important point, I think, to understand. But that's the value that you get from that excess premium that you get in periods of bull markets comes with a little bit of pain, right? As Corey always says, no pain, no premium. So there is a little bit of pain here. Luckily, it's mixed in with the betas, so it doesn't feel too bad.
And you get the carry.
Correct.
Right. Anything else, guys?
Well, you know, we talked about a little bit about the systematic macro alpha in this structure of equities, bonds, and then the systematic macro alpha on top. I think one of the things I'm most excited about, aside from the kind of asset allocation that we created, is that we partnered with Longpoint ETFs to launch this ETF with Steve Hawkins and the team, who are experts at creating kind of tax corporate class structures that allow us to have, it's unlikely that we'll have a distribution at the end of the year. And what does that mean if we're not putting out distributions, taxable distributions at the end of the year? It means that if you invest in this ETF, we will be able to compound returns even outside of your registered accounts, right? And the thing about Canada and things like systematic macro and managed futures is that they are highly tax inefficient on as a standalone.
Right.
If your managed future strategy is up 10%, you have to mark to market that at the end of each calendar year and pay taxes as income on that gain. And so without an ability to kind of put this in a corporate class structure, it becomes, while still useful and diversified and so on, it becomes less palatable, right, at the end of the year when the client's paying taxes. So I think one of the key, and this is something that's unique to Canada, we haven't been able to do anything like that in the US or in Europe. It's a uniquely Canadian feature that we are incredibly excited to be part of and really brings the whole offering together for investors in Canada.
I love it. That's excellent. I mean, tax efficiency, you know, wow. I remember the days when, you know, investors got really upset that their mutual fund that was down for the year, calendar year, spat out a capital gains tax. You know,
it's happened to us in the US. It's not nice.
People are, you know, investors and advisors alike are very sensitive to that. I mean,
yeah, so I think
that's an important benefit.
There's asset allocation alpha here. So what do we have here? I think we have three alphas, right? We have a structural alpha. The structure itself with the return stacking concept, I think, provides a level of what can be perceived as alpha. I think there's the stack, the systematic macro, the way we run it has an edge and has alpha that we expect to be, we're making sure that we're doing our best to outperform the systematic macro indices. And then there's this other kind of ETF structure alpha that allows investors to put more money in their pocket as we compound. So I think this to me is my Mona Lisa in terms of the triple alpha that we are attempting to offer. So very excited about that. And for people that want to learn more about it, you can go to returnstackedetfs.ca. And in there, you'll see a presentation, a product brief. We're about to launch a webinar. So if you subscribe to our newsletter, you'll be able to get that announcement. And, we've also written a ton on the insights section. And this will kind of kick you off to the research site, returnstack.com, where you can learn about, you know, if you have any questions, we've probably answered them. But obviously, in that same page, you can contact us on and schedule a call with a Calendly link in the contact section. So if you have any specific questions to your business, we always partner and help you understand and help you put together better portfolios with our product suite.
I want to say, you know, like we've had so many, anybody that's been watching, you know, following Raise Your Average, we've had so many conversations about this topic over the years we've been doing this. And it's hard for me not to feel like all those conversations and that time spent with you providing all that research, this is the culmination of that. Like all those conversations have led to this moment in time where, you know, all the problems that you talked about, it's interesting, like as far as a stream of consciousness, how that, you know, the stream of consciousness that you have created has led to this moment, this innovation that you brought to market for advisors to be able to exploit this opportunity as well in building better portfolios.
It only took us 20 years, Pierre.
Is that all?
It took us 20 years. Time well spent. But to that point, Pierre, you know, and Ron said putting it the best foot forward, it is that culmination of strategy thinking, right? All the research and time and effort, putting it into a product design that we think solves a fundamental problem that investors have. So not only do we think it has a very attractive return profile, but it truly helps solve these problems. And then as Rodrigo mentioned in the end, wrapping it in a structure that we think is a structural advantage from a tax perspective, right? All of that coming together for us is, you know, what's taken so long. We're really excited about bringing something like this to market.
What a conversation. Thank you both so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight. It's been terrific catching up with you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Pierre.
Yeah, thank you for having us.